safe are our schools? Welcome to The Full Story. I'm Rebecca Saran, in for Ron Ropiak. Last week, Governor Cuomo signed legislation banning teachers from carrying guns in schools. Security guards, resource officers, and police are still allowed to bring guns onto school property. However, previously anyone with written permission was allowed to carry. Joining us today to discuss this is Michael Gormley. He's from Newsday. He covers Albany. As well as Keith Scott, he joins us to help us look at the impact mass shootings have on the mental health of our students and which school safety measures make students feel the most safe and comfortable. Mike, I'd like to start with you. Tell me a little bit about Governor Cuomo signed 6 gun control laws last week, one banning teachers from carrying guns on school grounds. What inspired him to do this? Because this was prior to the mass shootings in Texas and Ohio.
Yes, well, the governor, as you know, has this has always been a big part of his legislative history, going back to 2013 when he pushed through what was called the SAFE Act. It was a broad gun control act after the Sandy Hook massacre. This latest one, or one of the latest ones that he did, was on teachers. Really came from the noise following President Donald Trump's view that, you know, maybe teachers should be armed. This was after one of the previous school shootings, and the momentum built here in New York to not allow this to happen. Not that we had any evidence that any school district was doing this, but this law prohibits any teacher or administrator from carrying a gun on school grounds. And interestingly, on the it allows for guards and resource officers, which are usually police officers, to have guns on school property, but only if that's their primary job. So there's no loophole here where a teacher can be a part-time resource officer and carry a gun.
Now, I know you brought up President Trump, and President Trump and the NRA had promoted the idea, saying that teachers can engage a shooter immediately, therefore cutting down on the response time, saving lives. Why did the governor think that that idea is flawed?
Well, I think that one of the major elements of this effort has been a case or two where we found where the a teacher in another state had left a gun in a restroom. There's also concerns about the many accidents that can happen. And there's also the concern about theft. But I think that that incident where a teacher had accidentally left a pistol in a restroom gave people something to latch on to. And they're concerned. I mean, schools, there are no schools that we have around here, at least in our cities or in our big suburbs, that want to have teachers armed. The idea of putting more guns in schools seems to be wrong-headed, and that's what that's Governor Cuomo's position anyway.
Yeah, cynics say this legislation, along with the other pieces of legislation, were sitting on the governor's desk for 6 months. If it was so important to him, he would have signed it far sooner. What's your response?
Well, I think it's a good point, except that these do take time. You would have thought that he would have moved this a lot sooner, but in Albany, bills, even after they're approved, sometimes involve other agreements. The governor's answer for this was he was still working with the legislators on this, on some of the details of it, and they could always issue what are called chapter amendments, which make slight changes to these bills. But in the end, the legislature didn't send it up to him that quickly. So the legislature was also holding off on this.
Yeah, what was the governor's thinking? We talked a moment ago about response times, rapid response. But for the more rural school districts, that perhaps first responders could be 20 minutes away. Therefore, it might make sense to have a teacher have the ability to carry a weapon.
Well, you know, that perspective has some merit. In rural areas, an awful lot of these, but a lot of teachers are often hunters, very experienced. They could be veterans. They could get the training that would be required, that other states require, that allow this sort of thing to happen, and be there a lot sooner. The other part of that argument, which I think resonated even with some critics of this, even supporters of the of banning teachers from having guns made sense. The idea is that teachers with guns could be a deterrent to shootings in the first place. But those arguments didn't carry much weight here in New York.
As I mentioned a moment ago, also with us today is Keith Scott. He is the director of education at the Long Island Safe Center, which houses the office of the NASA Child Advocate. Their multidisciplinary team provides supportive services to children and their families who have dealt with abuse and traumatic situations. Keith, welcome to The Full Story.
Thank you for having me.
How do you think kids react to the idea or the presence of a teacher on school property with a gun?
You know, this is a troubling time for children to be in school with everything that's going on. You know, they're keenly aware of the realities faced by going to school. And it's said that our schools have essentially become a war zone in some communities, as we've seen. So, you know, seeing a firearm could evoke many feelings of stress and trauma for a child that does not understand. Once again, they're not walking to a military operation. It's supposed to be a school zone where they're supposed to feel comfortable, where they're supposed to be in an environment conducive to their learning. So with that being said, it could become very troubling. I mean, just off the fact by itself that children know about the prevalence of school shootings is troubling in itself, and there's children having hard times paying attention when they might hear a loud bang in the hallway, whether it's the AC turning on or someone dropping a textbook. That evokes certain feelings of stress and activates the stress response in the body.
It's interesting. We were talking before this program about Columbine. Hard to believe that was 20 years ago. Has this whole world of mass shootings and school shootings, has this become, in a very perverse sense, almost a new normal for America's young people?
You know, it is, and it's very troubling and sad for me to say that, but it is. You know, we've become so accustomed to this. You know, back when Columbine happened, look at the mass outcry. That was the first major school shooting we've seen, at least covered by the media to that extent. And there was a huge outcry, and people were talking about it for months and months and months on end. Now we have a school shooting. They're pretty prevalent, and we're so desensitized to them. So there's not the same response is not evoked from Columbine that it is that we see now with all these mass shootings. Mm. So it's a sad reality that we've come to accept that this is our norm to some extent.
You know, Michael, I know one of the other pieces of legislation that the governor signed had to do with gun owners locking up their guns if there's somebody under the age of 16 living in the home. Was that another important part for the governor in terms of school safety, just because more times than not, the guns that are used in school shootings are those that the shooter has gotten from a family member, a friend, from his own home?
Right. That was an element of it. It really follows, though, an even broader bill that was signed into law just a month or two ago, our red flag law, which when there are guns in the house, if there's anyone in the house who's considered a threat, and a family member could say that they've made threatening statements to either harm themselves or others, then someone in the family or a friend could go to a judge, and a judge could hear the case and decide whether to remove those guns. So the locking of guns with anyone, you know, the teenager in the house, is part of that whole red flag effort to try to get to the point of keeping these firearms away from kids who could be making rash decisions or decisions based on some kind of mental illness.
What is the governor hearing from residents? Do they feel like the governor is doing enough? Do they feel as if he's dropping the ball on this?
The governor says that he has gotten nothing but support on this, including from legal gun owners. Clearly, if you talk to legal gun owners and to the affiliate we have for the NRA here, legal gun owners are generally in the polls supportive of almost all of these measures, particularly those that come with locking up weapons, which most responsible legal gun owners already do, and also for background checks, for mental illness, for criminal activity, that type of thing. I'm not sure it's as broad a support as the governor seems to think it is, because I know people in our rural areas feel that this has been an assault on their rights for gun ownership, and that laws are only followed by people who follow the laws anyway, not people who are breaking the laws or are doing these shootings. So I think there's a lot more animosity than the governor seems to think, but he is he's satisfied that the political hit he took on this has been well justified.
And Keith, Michael brought up a moment ago red flag provisions, and the states, they're in various forms depending on the state where they're put into place. But at the crux, it's if you identify somebody you think is in trouble, to let someone know, to let authorities know. This is putting an additional responsibility, at the very least, on our young people, isn't it?
It is. It is, you know. So the red flag law, it is important that gun owners do lock up their guns and gun safety is taught. But, you know, there's obviously not enough being done right now considering the amount of mass shootings that we have. And once again, you know, it is troubling to our young people knowing the realities they face every single day just walking into a school that this could be their last time walking in. So it just adds to that layer of trauma and stress faced in the school environment.
And what about, though, having to... We used to say, rat out your friend. I mean, really, there's a discomfort level that comes with that.
Yeah, it's also that whole, do not snitch mentality amongst their young people as
right.
to not rat out their friends. And, you know, once again, I'm not sure we're at the point where if someone makes a threat, people are comfortable coming forwards with it. I mean, some people have, and we've prevented shootings in the past, but we're not at the point where we're on the societal norm of us being like, you know what, if someone's making a threat, if someone's talking like this, it's not okay.
All right. Michael Gormley from Newsday covering Albany. Thanks for joining us. Keith Scott, you'll stay with us, and we'll continue as we examine safety in our schools as we embark on a brand new school year. This is The Full Story. We'll be back after a break. And welcome back to The Full Story. Today we're looking at school safety as we approach a new school year and in light of the latest mass shootings in Ohio and Texas. Suffolk County has launched a new school safety initiative that will share live security camera footage in an active shooter situation. The program is called SHARE, Sharing to Help Access Remote Entry. It will be implemented countywide in September. Joining us today to tell us more about this is Suffolk County Police Commissioner Geraldine Hart. She'll be joining us in just a moment. We would like, though, at this point to continue our conversation with Keith Scott. He is the Director of Education at the Long Island Safe Center, which houses the office of the NASA Child Advocate. Keith, thanks for being back with us.
Thank you for having me.
You know, one of the issues, the underlying issues that tends to be overlooked is the more subtle relationships going on in school that can feed into much bigger reactions and like mass shootings. And that is harassment, bullying. Are schools getting better at identifying and treating that kind of behavior?
You know, they're getting better. There's more awareness campaigns going on. Schools are definitely talking about it on a much more prevalent basis. But with that being said, children today are growing up in a completely different environment than you or I or their parents may have grown up in, where if someone was bullied, let's say, 15, 20, 25 years ago, the bullying stopped at the end of the day. Not saying it was any less traumatic, but the bullying didn't follow them when they walked in their door. Nowadays, as we all know, every single child is so connected to social media that they're bullied 24/7 now, and the bullying doesn't just stop at the school doors. So while schools are addressing it more, it's really difficult to address something that's still going on in the home environment as well.
So how do we, first of all, address that? And then how do we begin to alleviate some of this anxiety that our children are experiencing?
One, how do we address that? It's getting the parents involved. Actually, the answer to both those questions is getting the parents involved and having these open, difficult conversations. You know, it's difficult to have a conversation with your elementary school child or any child, as I can imagine, that saying, talking about the realities of school shootings, reassuring the children about the security systems in place, the new programs in Suffolk County, bringing those up to children, letting them know how they protect them. With that being said, too, how do we address these issues? It's more awareness on the school parts and more awareness to the parents, letting them know what their children are really facing, and talking about the downsides of living in a world where social media is so prevalent. once again, children live through their phones nowadays. Children live through Snapchat or Instagram or Facebook. So maybe it's having parents talking with them and having them limit the amount of time their children can spend on the social media sites, or raising awareness about the actual adverse effects of social media.
And let's talk a bit. In a moment, we'll be talking to Geraldine Hart about active shooter drills that they're going to begin them in Suffolk County. Are active shooter drills, do they do more harm than help our students?
You know, I'm sure it prepares the students for the horrible what-if scenario, just like how fire drills, you know, help students to understand where to go if something happens. Hopefully it's seen as an extra level of protection that the children experience. While I know it's disheartening, it's horrible for them to think about the shooting that could take place, the sad thing is this is a reality, and we have to prepare our children for the what-if event. So it could actually help them to understand what to do in that traumatic situation if, God forbid, it does happen.
Let's talk about the different ages. An active shooter drill for a 6-year-old is a little different than an active shooter drill for a 13-year-old. Are schools good at gauging the age appropriateness of preparedness?
You know, in the past, they've called them different drills. For example, they've called them a tornado warning for younger children than it would be a, you know, middle or high school child. And as we all know, Long Island doesn't have too many tornadoes. Mm-hmm. But with that being said, it's gauging in a different way, where you could be talking about a storm drill or just a negative event drill or something like that, with a little more playful title, of course. But some schools do that, and they don't talk about an active shooter drill in elementary school, where they may call it that in high school. But then again, you know, it's important that our young people do understand that, you know, there are negative events that could occur in school nowadays that weren't talked about 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago.
There are some parents that will say to you, my kid just is not a big talker, doesn't like to talk about his or her feelings, but I know something's going on. What kind of advice do you give them in this age of just news clips, social media? It's a 24/7 media world, to access what they're really thinking if they're not one to explain it through their words?
You know, a lot of children definitely are not big talkers, but most of them are big listeners. Now, they're very observant to their environment, and they understand what goes on around them. So maybe it's just the parent sitting down with the child over dinner, over a meal, over something, and just discussing what goes on and just talking. As long as the child's listening, while they may be uncomfortable, while they may seem like they don't want to hear it, as long as that dialogue is going on, that may elicit a response in the child with the child. Something, a light bulb goes off, and the child says, you know what, I am going through that. So it's pretty much just sitting down with the child and just laying out the reality of what's going on in society. While the parent might not have to call up a child, for example, like, are you being bullied? They could bring up a topic that, you know what, there are children being bullied. We understand there's issues going on with Facebook and Instagram, and diving into that conversation instead of singling out the child, talking about it more of a whole community norm, and making the child understand that the parent knows what's going on and the child is not alone. There's other children experiencing this as well. When a child feels more comfortable, doesn't feel singled out, they may be more likely to start talking about their own experiences.
And what about the children that don't have parents that are involved in their lives for whatever? There's many, many reasons, but they don't have that help at home.
You know, that's where it also comes with an adult, a teacher, a coach, a guidance counselor, a social worker, a principal. It's important that we have these conversations on a daily basis. I mean, look at how much schools talk about tobacco still to this day, about how bad it is. And today we know that tobacco is bad, and it's made a huge dent where children don't use tobacco as much as they used to, right? So it's important to have a reoccurring conversation. It's not one of those one-shot deals where you're like, you know what, bullying is dead. We know what's going on here. It's a continuous dialogue, and through that continuous dialogue in the classrooms and assemblies, if it's not at home, it's through coaches on sports fields, that continuous dialogue may promote a social change that we need to have.
In your conversations with teachers, I mean, this has put another, I wouldn't say burden, but certainly another responsibility on their list. A science teacher might say, I know the periodic table, but boy, I am not a student or a school psychologist.
Yeah, and you know what? That's an issue we see all the time when we go in, when school districts talk about trauma, talk about sexual assault, any variety of all the issues, especially substance abuse faced by our children today. But while that teacher may not, their focus may be on history or science. They have to understand that children, they have more than one focus. Children are bringing other experiences into that classroom. While that one lesson may be about biology, the students are experiencing other things. And it's important for students to feel comfortable talking to any teacher about any issues they have going on. And it's important for teachers to understand, too, that while they're an expert in one topic, it's also important to become knowledgeable about all other topics, knowledgeable about the other things faced by children. And it's understandable. The issue is that teachers have a very small amount of time to fit in everything, especially with the Common Core guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important to carve out at least a couple minutes to talk about these other issues, because these are things children want to talk about, and these are things that children are facing whether we talk about them or not. And the only way to prevent them is to talk about them and have an open dialogue.
And what do you believe are the best school safety measures that will protect our students, but they will feel comfortable, relaxed, and able to learn at the same time?
Best school safety measures, one would be having, once again, an open dialogue, having a continuous forum, having a culture that promotes acceptance, promotes harmony, promotes peace, and shuns bullying, shuns abuse whatsoever. Having open conversations, conversations with law enforcement, inviting law enforcement in, having a law enforcement presence on campus. It doesn't have to be a negative adversarial presence. It's just understanding that law enforcement are our friends, having them come in, having them talk about certain topics going on. So it's a school environment that promotes peace, promotes harmony, and also promotes dialogue and has open dialogue and has these uncomfortable conversations, because those are things that make children feel more comfortable. It makes them feel heard and makes them feel accepted.
All right. Keith Scott, Director of Education at the Long Island Safe Center, which is the office of the Nassau Child Advocate. Thanks for bringing us your unique perspective today.
Thank you for having me. Take care.
Thank you. And recently on our program, we talked about school safety and arming security guards and having them on campus. Let's listen in. On our last program on school safety, we spoke with the now retired superintendent of Regional School District 10, Alan Biteman. The district serves the communities of Burlington and Harwinton in Connecticut. It was the first district in the state to hire armed security guards to protect their schools. Biteman said it was the school shooting in Parkland, Florida that inspired the action.
Our Board of Education, our two first selectmen, our local police department, and our state troopers got together and began having a discussion about arming our security guards. We were fortunate to be able to hire retired state troopers and retired municipal police to serve as our security guards. They were coming to us having served in good standing for 20, 25, 30 years as police officers, many of them of rank, sergeants, lieutenants, captains, and so forth. And they were looking for some part-time work, and we were looking for people who had an instinct for trouble and an ability to de-escalate and to respond quickly. And over time, we hired 8 security guards, all of them coming out of municipal or state police.
It's been a year now since the armed guards were hired. Although the idea was met with some skepticism at first, Biteman said the reaction from parents was mostly positive.
A lot of concern, I think, the first week. We're 3-4 months into school. I still get parents who stop me and say thank you. I have grandparents who say, you know, my daughter works in your school. I can sleep well knowing that she's safe and when she goes to work. So we had a struggle with that. I think the community had a brief tussle with it itself. And when it came down to the gun in the school or no protection for the staff, students, and visitors for 5 to 7 minutes, I think everybody came to the realization, while it's not the best solution, it's the one that will protect us all.
Thank you.
And joining us now is Geraldine Hart, the Suffolk County Police Commissioner. Suffolk County has launched a new school safety initiative that will share live security camera footage in an active shooter situation. It's called SHARE, Sharing to Help Access Remote Entry, and it's going to be implemented countywide in September. We welcome Geraldine Hart to the program today. Nice to have you here.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
I know that you just not too long ago left a news conference talking about putting into play active shooter drills. Tell us about the announcement.
We did. So we have been conducting active shooter live drills throughout the police district for some time now. But we wanted to really just make the public aware of all the steps that we're taking as a department and how we prioritize this, obviously. And also announce some new upcoming active shooter drills, one which will be in the West Babylon School District before September. So really just to make the public aware of everything that the department is doing and everything that we are looking to expand upon and make sure that that we all feel safe.
So these active shooter drills are not going to involve students then. This is just really for teachers, administrators, and first responders.
That's correct. So we're looking for the time frame where there is no students in session. So summer school is going on now. We'll have a short window before school begins. But no, it's absolutely inappropriate to have children as part of this this drill in particular. But what we do hope to do is make sure that we are testing the program, the SHARE program. We're going to have our real-time crime center online. We'll have our detectives there viewing the inside of the school, eyes on the ground. We'll have our first responders there, and they will be conducting what will be obviously a simulated active shooter drill.
Yeah, give us a better understanding how this works, because first of all, it's implementing technology, which more and more schools are going to find they're going to have to do and to prevent some mass shooter situations. And it's this relationship between police departments, both state and local, and the school and education system. Tell us about SHARE.
Exactly. So I do want to preface this by saying we have an excellent relationship with our Suffolk County superintendents, and it's just been terrific. So we've partnered for a long time on these initiatives, and I do just want to thank them for that. But so in particular, SHARE, as you said, Sharing to Help Access Remote Entry, is a vital tool to us. If the need ever arises to respond to an active shooter in school, we're able to monitor and really be eyes in the school to see exactly what happens. But we know that seconds matter, and every second saved could mean another life is spared. So we'll tap into their closed circuit TV cameras, and we'll be able to monitor what is going on in our real-time crime center. We'll be able to call out what we're seeing to our first responders as well as school administrators in the school. If the school has the capability, there's also the possibility of accessing their doors so that if there is a locked entry, rather than waste the time in trying to breach that door, we're able to remotely unlock an access point, which, again, could save seconds, which is so imperative.
How many schools have closed-circuit television systems?
So they all do. They all have closed-circuit TV, most, I should say, if not all. And this is actually at no cost to the district, that enables us to tap in. And I do want to obviously preface all of this by saying privacy is utmost, you know, concern to us as well, and this will only be activated in an emergency situation.
As part of this is threat assessment, I know, trying to prevent this as opposed to react to it. Is a threat assessment, is that part of this?
Absolutely. So here in the department, we're always looking at, first and foremost, prevention. On something like this. So we have teams in the precincts that if there's a threat that comes in, we run that to ground, we assign it locally within the precinct, and then if it's appropriate, we'll bring additional resources in to ensure that we're dealing with this threat. We've done more than, I would say, 400 just last year on just people calling in to, you know, say that they have a concern, whether it be a student posting on social media or an adult that is acting in some way that's concerning. So we're always on top of that and making sure that we are running those fully out and making sure that we're doing everything we need to do to address those.
And what about hiring third-party social media monitoring companies? Are schools looking in that direction?
So it's hard to say on behalf of the schools. I could tell you internally, we do a tremendous amount of social media mining and making sure that we are seeing what's going on social media platforms. But as far as the school, I would imagine that that's an area that they would be interested in as well, because there's just, as you know, so much out there that's being posted and so much intel that can be gleaned from that.
And very briefly, what is the Rave Panic Button app, and how's that work?
So we have 90% of our schools signed up for the Rave app. So that delivers critical data about emergencies directly to our 911 dispatchers and first responders. So that's actually an app on the smartphone where if there is an incident of an active shooter, a touch of a button will connect somebody to our dispatchers, and we can make sure that we're getting that information out.
Well, it sounds like you've been fully prepared in many of these areas. Good luck with those active shooter drills coming up right before the school year starts. Geraldine Hart.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Commissioner Suffolk County Police. And the full story will continue after a break. And welcome back to The Full Story. I'm Rebecca Saran, filling in for Ron Ropiak today as we get ready to start a brand new school year. We're examining school safety. A recent audit from the comptroller says in New York, they're not doing enough to protect students from mass shootings. The State Department of Education failed to monitor New York school districts' compliance with the Safe Schools Against Violence in Education, called the SAVE Act. Joining me now to discuss this is Tom DiNapoli, the New York State comptroller. Welcome to The Full Story.
Nice to be with you, Rebecca. Thank you for having me.
So, Tom, according to what I read about the audit, your department looked at 17 school districts in New York and two charter schools, and not one of those school safety plans met minimum requirements. First of all, it's surprising in and of itself, but what really stands out is meeting minimum requirements. Were you surprised?
Disappointed, I guess surprised to an extent, but, you know, that audit is one of a series of audits we've had underway looking at this whole issue of school safety. As you pointed out at the outset, New York has a law on the books. It's been on the books for a number of years called the SAVE Act, the Safe Schools Against Violence in Education Act, which was meant to anticipate emergency preparedness for all of our schools. The law was passed before this era of the school shootings that seem so such a pervasive problem across our country. So we wanted to do a check and see where we're at in terms of implementation of the SAVE Act, particularly with a view of the fact that there are new kinds of emergencies that probably weren't anticipated, at the time that the law was enacted. So, I think it was a concern when we saw just from that limited sample the number of schools that weren't meeting any of the requirements. Again, it's a sample, but I think it says a lot. We also did audits of New York City schools, how the Department of Education in the city is ensuring compliance with the SAVE Act. And then overall responsibility, of course, is with the State Education Department. So in all cases, we found, to use, I guess, the lingo schools would use, much need of improvement in all categories.
So what are some of the requirements? Give us some examples of requirements that are not being met by the school districts.
Well, I mean, some things that may sound pretty obvious, designation of a chief emergency officer, not only designating the person, but identifying what the duties would be, including how the point person would interact with state and local law enforcement, to have an emergency plan to be adopted, as part of that adoption to make sure there's an opportunity for input from the public, have a public hearing, in effect, a meeting and an opportunity for people to offer comment, have it be filed with the State Education Department, so that they could make sure that there is compliance, establishment of a safety team, for our schools. Those are the kinds of examples. School boards are required to have input, public input on safety plans by having a comment period and adopting those plans by September 1st before the start of a school year. Filing of building plans, very important for first responders, for police and emergency responders to know what the layout of a building is. And so if they don't have plans or up-to-date plans, I think that's another issue that, schools filed plans a number of years ago, but they've had alterations or changes. and they haven't kept current. So, you know, those are among the kinds of requirements and expectations that we have. And again, it's part of it's the responsibility of the local districts. But the other responsibility very clearly is with the State Education Department. And they have devoted, unfortunately, very limited staff resources to make sure that there's compliance. So part of what we've really called for is for state ed to beef up its staffing. And they had in the past something called the New York State Safe Schools Task Force to really provide input as to how we're complying with the requirements of the SAVE Act. We think it's time that they reengage that task force.
How much of this is a money issue? The schools say we have limited resources, we're doing the best that we can, and, you know, actually, it doesn't sound like we haven't dropped the ball the way the audit makes it sound. We just didn't fill out all the, you know, every single line in the paperwork, or it was just like nitty gritty little mistakes that we made. How do you respond to them?
Well, from my perspective, documentation is always important, and you know, it's one thing to believe informally that people have an understanding of what to do. It's another thing to have the plans very clearly spelled out and for the requirements of the law to be followed. I mean, first of all, schools are like any other organization, made up of people. There are folks always coming and going. It's not a static group of people. So, you know, there are always new people there. I think, you know, look, there's I don't know anybody who wouldn't like to do, you know, have more resources to do more of what they'd like to do. But the reality is many of the shortfalls that we identified, you know, really aren't a money question. It really is just a question of following what should be part of the routine. And again, I think in the face of what we're seeing in this very troubling world and time we're living through right now, I would think that school safety, complying with the law, making sure it's a safe environment, making sure you are prepared and your staff and your students are prepared for the horrible possibility of an emergency with an active shooter on a school campus. If that doesn't take priority over many other requirements, I don't know what else should. So, you know, in some cases, maybe a few more resources would help, but I think much of this is more a question of priority rather than resources. And that's why we're going to continue to take a look at this issue. I think we'll be doing some more samples. We haven't formally adopted a further audit plan on this, but when, you know, you consider the hundreds of school districts across our state, you know, doing a narrow sample is helpful, but, you know, I think there's more work that needs to be done, and we want people to know that at the very least our office is going to be examining how they're complying with the requirements of the law.
Many of our listeners live on Long Island. How did the Long Island schools that were part of the audit, how did they fare in comparison to other school districts?
Well, you know, we found some challenges there as well. You know, we're somewhat sensitive to the fact that some of this information is appropriately confidential in terms of specifics of what lapses may have occurred in which districts or which buildings for obvious reasons. We don't want anybody to get any ideas. So, you know, I would just say broadly that we saw some of the limitations on the Long Island schools that we saw in some of the other regions of the state as well. You know, certainly in terms of holding a public hearing, you know, that was an example of one of the Long Island school districts that we saw that did not happen or didn't provide the 30-day comment period. So, you know, again, we purposely, in the interest of security, did not delineate in any great detail between these multiple audits, you know, specifics about particular school buildings or school districts. But suffice it to say, Long Island, like every other region that we examined, there certainly were gaps in what needed to be done.
And how do you feel about the governor's new law banning teachers from carrying guns on school grounds? What's your reaction to that?
Well, my own feeling is that arming teachers is not the solution to the problem. Having more guns on a school campus, to me, is not the solution. Although I didn't have a vote on it, not a legislator anymore. I represented Long Island for many years. I would have voted for that had I been in the legislature. But, you know, I think the reality is for New York, I don't think you saw too many folks clamoring for teachers to be armed anyway. So I think it probably sent a strong message, that, you know, and a strong statement, which I think is important. But in terms of the reality, I'm not aware of too many teachers or school districts that were looking to arm the teachers. I know that's been an issue in other states, but I think New York, fortunately, has had a different attitude about guns in public places, and I think that's been a good thing for our state.
I know on this program we talked earlier about threat assessments, trying to prevent violent actions from happening as opposed to reacting. Are threat assessments part of the SAVE Act?
Not directly, not in the sense that I think you were discussing it earlier, but I do think that is something that needs to be looked at. You know, and some of that, when you look at some of the things that have happened in some of the other school settings where you've had these horrendous situations, you know, identification of young people who are having serious issues, mental health issues, having staff understand what the warning signs are, letting families know where it is that they could go if they want help for a young person in their family who may be having big issues. I think the concern as we all move forward in this terrible time is, you know, will you see more people being copycats, you know, to use that phrase? I mean, how horrendous was it, you know, to have El Paso and then followed, you know, within hours by Dayton? And to what extent did what happened in El Paso, you know, have something snap in the mind of the killer in Dayton? I mean, I don't have the answer to that, but it certainly begs the question or you go back to, you know, to Columbine years ago. I mean, how much of this is internalized with some of these really disturbed individuals? And if you're talking about a school setting, a young person, how could we better give school personnel the tools to identify the loner or the person who seems disengaged, who could, God forbid, also undertake such a horrendous violent act? Very complicated issue, clearly, but looking for more of those red flags is probably something we all need to do a better job of, certainly in the schools, but probably an issue for the workplace as well, or any time there's a public gathering.
Yeah, does your report dig into some of the more harder to detect problems like bullying or harassment that oftentimes trigger the more violent outbursts and behavior?
Well, a different audit did that. The Dignity for All Students Act is another law that New York has on the books, really to deal with that issue of bullying or any kind of discriminatory action based on race or gender, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender identification. There as well, we did audits for New York City schools and for schools outside of New York City, and we found some of the similar issues. Staff at the local level sometimes being unsure of what's required of them by the law, and therefore having an inability to appropriately implement the law. In the case of the Dignity for All Students Act, part of what's required is a reporting of when there's an incident of bullying or harassment of any kind, and then a requirement for State Education Department to make sure there's compliance. So there, too, was a situation where we urged a State Education Department to be more proactive in terms of providing guidance and training at the local school district level to make sure that they're complying with those requirements. So I think you raise an important question, and I do think there is a connection between the SAVE Act and the Dignity for All Students Act, the acronym there is DASA, that needs to be considered as well.
And you bring up a good point about training, and you mentioned a moment ago how fluid schools are, people coming and going, and every year there's changes to staff.
Yeah.
Keeping staff and administrators updated on their training has got to be a monumental task. Are schools keeping up with it?
Well, I think based on what we've seen, the results have been mixed in that regard, and they need to do a better job. But schools also build in, you know, superintendent conference days and, you know, training sessions. I mean, that's part of the routine as well. I think our message is that with all the other training and guidance and directives that you provide, this needs to be at the top of the list. We understand that schools are there to provide quality education, but the reality is, you know, the schools have to deal with all of the societal issues and problems that are out there. And this horrendous epidemic of gun violence that we're seeing, it has not left the school campuses out. And so we have to be thankful that in New York we haven't seen, you know, a Parkland or, you know, or a Sandy Hook, but it doesn't mean that it couldn't happen here. So we need to be as vigilant as possible. And, you know, when they're doing the first week of school, it starts with a day or two of superintendent conferences and the principals get together with their teams. You know, this issue needs to be, unfortunately, on the top of the list.
And one of the biggest challenges seems to be monitoring social media. And we were talking a moment ago with Geraldine Hart about, you know, third-party monitoring of social media. And you get into, you know, you get into privacy issues, et cetera.
You get into a lot.
A lot. However,
Much
of these conversations and the initial hints that there's a big problem brewing, that you can identify them on social media.
Well, especially now, I mean, young people are, I'm a little past that generation, so it's not where I spend a lot of my time, but we certainly know, you know, from our younger friends and relatives, that's a lot of how they occupy their time. But it's not an issue that we've looked at from an audit perspective, but I think that is, you know, and I did hear the tail end of your discussion with the police commissioner. I mean, I think it is something that law enforcement or certain other levels of government, they've got to look to that. But it's very complex. It's what you said. It's the privacy issue. It's the you know, you don't want to go after somebody unfairly, but also you don't want to underestimate you know, somebody saying something that in fact could be an indication of a very disturbed mind. And I think that's one of the, you know, the issues with social media, you know, or texting or even emails. I mean, I think people tend to, even older folks, I won't just label this on the young people, people, I think, sometimes take very lightly some of the things that they communicate through those different media. And I think they should be much more self-controlling in terms of some of their comments. And because if we do have to be in a phase where there's more surveillance, I think some of the things that people may even say innocently will be read in a different way. And so I think a little more self-control and to your the point of your question, more vigilance as well, all of that's required. I mean, look at the fellow in El Paso. I mean, he posted that manifesto. You know, I mean, if that shouldn't have been a tip-off. And then, of course, we're hearing some of the news today that apparently his mother called the authorities at one point, you know, questioning her son buying the weapon that he bought. I mean, you know, that's what's troubling when you hear about some of these indications, you know, and maybe in isolation they might not have meant a whole lot, but you start to string some of these things together and it should be, wow, maybe this is something we should have anticipated.
You know, you bring up a good point. I know Governor Cuomo, I believe was part of the package of gun bills he signed into law about safe storage. And working with families, so often these weapons come from friends and family. The kids have access to them. They shouldn't have access to them. How important is it for schools to have that conversation with families in terms of if you have a weapon, lock it up?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think it's an excellent point because, look, I mean, the reality is there are many people that have guns. They are entitled to have guns, you know, within the law and under appropriate situations. But that gun safety and the safe storage is key. How many times do we hear of the accident, right, where, you know, the kids end up playing with a gun that they should have never had access to? So I think that part of information, again, we hate to put so much on the schools. You know, I can see some of teachers listening to us are just saying, wait a minute, you're making us solve all these problems. Well, you know, we know you can't. But on the other hand, you know, you tend to have the audience and you have access to families and, you know, safety issues at home are important to a young person being able to show up at school, you know, healthy and in a frame of mind to be able to learn. So, yeah, I think unfortunately that would be a very helpful safety hint to remind parents of.
Yes, we are demanding much of our teachers more than we ever have before.
Well, you know, something, and that's why when people, you know, knock the teachers or, you know, we're always very protective of pension benefits for our public employees, including our teachers, you know, I served on the school board for 10 years on Long Island and got to see up close the, you know, all the problems show up at the school. You know,
all right.
Don't create the problems, but they have to deal with them. So being a teacher is an honorable profession.
All right. Tom DiNapoli, New York State Comptroller, thanks for joining us.